Listen to me, you star-flung entities. This isn't easy. It never has been, if you want to know the truth. A being in possession of supernatural powers and a world-altering mission oft-time finds himself down in the dumps for weeks on end. He endures periods of psychic sludge where the emotional landscape looks like a riverbank at low tide on an overcast day. All the best sources agree that these bleak periods are necessary to spiritual evolution. It isn't depression. It's a dark night of the soul. Doubts. Before me rises the possibility that what I had taken as sacred text was all along merely pulp fiction. Night after night of dark night, I whisper to myself, your life is a grotesque error. Only days ago, confident energy sent me loping through the night streets, abuzz with pleasure that Star's wretched brat was to meet an excruciating death. Now, I think I was mistaken. I think I got it wrong. If you do not exist, if the elder gods did not place me on Earth to prepare its destruction, what am I doing here? Who was my true father? I didn't have a prayer of getting back to sleep, so I brushed my teeth, washed, and shaved, telling myself that the money in my jacket pocket had been a part of the nightmare. I put on my socks and regarded the knapsack. I reached inside, and my hand came back into view, gripping a fat wad of bills. I rammed the money back into the pouch, zipped it shut, shoved the knapsack under the bed, and went down to the kitchen. A purple shirt hung from Uncle Clark's shoulders. He looked like a conga player awaiting the summons on stage, but what he was waiting for was breakfast.
Cereal is down at the end. Bowls are right in front of you.
He monitored the buckshot rattle of the cereal into the bowl and nodded when it was half filled. He slid his ivory eyes toward me.
From all that racket you made last night, I guess you had a grade A nightmare. What was it about?
I was in a big storm.
They say a dream of heavy rainfall indicates unexpected money.
What about almost being struck by lightning?
Well, that's supposed to mean a change of fortune. Could be a whole lot of money coming your way.
I had an uneasy vision of the bills folded into my knapsack.
Rainstorms now. We used to get us some doozies in the old days. The river rolled right into town, picked up anything it could get along the way. Cars, livestock, full-grown men. In the water, a corpse will turn blue. It will swell up with gas and float on the current. The hands will look like catcher's mitts.
I told him that until yesterday, when I had seen the river from St. Anne's, I had nearly forgotten that Edgerton was built along the Mississippi. He gave me a frown sneer.
Best part of a river is when it lets you forget it. Way back, we needed the river. And a river town is a different kind of place.
Different how?
A river town is irregular. You get your gamblers and your sharpies before you get your preachers. And it might be some considerable time before any of them find an advantage in turning respectable. There's a different mentality, you understand me? And maybe you go 20 years without a flood. If one comes, you build everything back up afterwards. The river needs the town, and the town needs the river. A month or two later, even the smell is gone.
The smell? Clark gave me a prolonged smirk sneer.
I have pondered the question of why a river will smell fresh and clean when it runs between its banks, and will leave behind such a stink after it floods. I believe the answer is that a flood will turn a river upside down and bring the bottom to the top. River bottom is what is supposed to be kept out of sight. River bottom is the ugly part of nature, where everything gets broken down and turned into something else. It has a lot of death in it.
Must be hard to clean up.
That stuff will cling. I figure Edgerton rebuilt itself 3 times between the 1870s and the start of the century. It was at that time your people arrived in Edgerton, you know. The famous Dunstan brothers. Omar and Sylvan, 1874. Omar and Sylvan? I never heard of them before. The Dunstan brothers rode into town in the back of a hay wagon and jumped off with a couple of valises and $200 in gold coins. Everything they touched prospered. When the floods came along, Omar and Sylvan bought land where they figured the town would grow. Handsome as the devil, they say. You can put your money on one thing. They were let into a lot of nice houses when the mister wasn't at home. Omar married a woman from New Orleans named Ethel Bridges and settled down a bit. Still and all, one morning he left the house we're sitting in right now, and someone shot him dead while he was walking to his carriage. Sylvan married his brother's widow, built a house outside of town, and moved in. He and Ethel had some kids, 3, 4, nobody knows for sure. A long time ago, an old-timer told me the Dunstan brothers never knew if their babies were going to come out deformed in some way medicine never heard about. Like with a huge big head and a body no bigger than a pin. Nearly all those babies died, he told me, but the few that lived were kept in the attic. He glanced at me. Howard, the oldest child in the family, overheard more than was good for a little boy, which could explain why the man became so wild and squandered his money. Howard did considerable damage all in all. Toward the end, I believe he was plumb out of his head. You'd have to say he was in a kind of dream world. I thought all of it had come from the dream world, specifically the dream world invented in the rumor mills of a small town. When Howard, the oldest son, came of age, Edgerton wasn't the way it used to be. They got respectable, I said. Clark nodded. Howard ran to seed. The Hatches and the Miltons took advantage of his weakness. The stairs creaked, and Clark straightened up in his chair. Best not go into this around Aunt Nettie. Registering suspicion, Aunt Nettie lowered her eyebrows at Clark. Surprised to see you up so soon. She turned her attention to me. From what I heard, you thought the devil was after you. Aunt Nettie started making breakfast. The doorbell chimed. There's May, Aunt Nettie said. Would you let her in, Nettie? A UPS driver in a summer uniform stood on the porch, holding a box wrapped in butcher paper. Delivery for Miss Star Dunstan? I carried the package into the kitchen. UPS. Star must have sent some of her things before she came here. The doorbell rang again. I went back through the living room and opened the door. Resplendent in a flowered hat, Aunt May extended a gnarled paw and clung to me on the way to the kitchen. I sat down between May and Aunt Nettie under Clark's ripe gaze. The telephone rang. I answered, and a doctor informed me that my mother had experienced another stroke 30 minutes earlier, and that the efforts to revive her had been unsuccessful. I hung up and saw their faces staring at me, suspended between hope and what they already knew to be the truth. Nearly was killed. Neither Aunt Nettie nor Clark had seemed heartbroken when I told them not to expect me for dinner. Aunt Nettie had not forgiven me for the crime of squandering far too much money on a coffin earlier in the day. My hour and a half with Aunt Joy and Uncle Clarence had been even worse. I went over with the idea that I was performing an act of charity for two old people. I hoped for some information about the interesting figure of Howard Dunstan, and I wanted to see what would happen when I brought up Edward Reinhardt. Mindless as an infant, and like an infant oblivious to the stench of his own excrement, Clarence slumped over the leather strap, pinning him to his wheelchair. Joy told me that every night at 7 she pushed him down the hall to the tub and cleaned him off. We sat in the two chairs that were their living room furniture. Joy, the youngest and most diminished of Howard Dunstan's daughters, perched on the edge of her chair, and her bitterness claimed all the conversational space. Clark's river bottom had poured into Joy's house, and coated everything with what he called the ugly part of nature. Now I barreled along Pine Street to Commercial Avenue, the center of town. Ahead of me, a couple with the uncomplicated, affable assurance of Midwestern wealth spun out of a revolving door of Merchant's Hotel. The dark-haired woman sent me an irritated glare. Her husband noticed the look on her face, glanced at me, and abruptly pulled himself upright.
"Do you require some form of assistance?"
"I'm looking for a good restaurant. What would you recommend?" He swept his hand toward the building beside us.
"Le Madrigal, right off the lobby. It's pricey, though. And a word of advice, buddy. Stop off at the boys' room first and make yourself presentable."
I tilted my face toward his leathery ear. "I don't need your advice, you overbearing small-town shithead." Recoiling like a compressed spring, he grabbed his wife's arm and yanked her into the street. Inside, I went up a carpeted flight of stairs. A head waiter whose name tag identified him as Vincent conducted me to a table near the bar. I opened the menu and heard someone speak my name. Ashley Ashton was moving across the room. From the other side of their window table, Laurie Hatch raised her eyebrows and gave me a look that weakened my knees. They invited me to join them. If Laurie Hatch saw anything unlikely in Ashley's story of giving me a ride to Edgerton, she kept her reservations to herself. Ashley had invited Laurie to dinner by reason of Laurie's connection to the legal case, but at first the connection went unexplained. "How is your mother doing?" Laurie asked. "What do the doctors say?" "They say she died this morning. They better be right because I just bought a coffin in a cemetery plot." They stared at me in shock. "I'm sorry, I shouldn't have put it like that. It's been a weird day." Ashley said, "At least you were able to spend a whole day with her. Could she talk to you?" "She was able to say a few things." Laurie asked, "Are you going to stay around after the funeral?"
"I might. I'd like to see more of the town."
"Let me be your tour guide. After all, I'm in your debt."
"Sounds like a great idea. Ashley, what's happening with your project?"
"If I don't get anywhere in the next day or two, I'll throw in the towel. The guy lives behind too many walls." "That's my estranged husband, Stuart," Laurie said. "I wish I could have been more helpful." Ashley said, "Laurie, you won't be in any trouble, will you?" Laurie shrugged. "I don't care if Stuart knows we had dinner together. Granny can't hurt me."
"Grenville Milton?" I asked.
"The one and only Groenvile," she said. "He left about 5 minutes before you got here."
"Is Groenvile a big old bald-headed character in a bow tie and a green linen jacket who thinks he owns the world? It took a turn for the worse when I called him an overbearing small-town shithead."
Laurie laughed. "If I'd heard you call Granny a shithead, I would have brightened up immediately." Ashley said, "Ned, let me put your dinner on my bill, will you? It's on the state of Kentucky. Laurie, thanks for a nice evening. I'll call you soon."
Ashley signed the check and pushed her chair away from the table, and we watched her wind through the tables. Laurie Hatch looked at me with a relaxed, self-possessed amusement. Then her smile changed.
"I know how it feels to lose your mother. How is your father doing?"
"I never knew my father. I didn't even know his name until yesterday when my mother told it to me. My family isn't too happy about that."
"Are they afraid of what you could find out?"
"God knows. My family is, let's say, eccentric."
I had a memory flash of Aunt Joy leaning forward and aiming a scrawny forefinger across the room to send Clarence's wheelchair rolling a yard forward, a yard back. She squinted. The wheelchair floated 4 feet off the ground and swung from side to side, while Clarence pushed his tongue in and out of his mouth in babyish pleasure. I heard Joy saying, "That's all I can do. Now most of my strength is gone. Wasn't supposed to end up like this, Nettie. We used to be like royalty in this town. Sylvan moved the family out of town, and he and Ethel had a batch of kids. But some of those children, my daddy said, they didn't look human at all."
Laurie asked, "What was your father's name?"
"Edward Reinhardt."
Saying it brought back the other name my mother had spoken.
"Robert."
Who is Robert?
What a great name, Laurie said.
Swirling Fog, Mr. Edward Reinhardt.
Excuse me?
Like the husband in Rebecca, one of my favorite movies.
She placed her hand over mine.
I was going to show you the delights of Edgerton anyhow, so let's see what we can turn up along the way.
We tried to work out where to meet tomorrow. Laurie suggested we meet near the main library.
A friend of mine, Hugh Coventry, who works at the library, volunteers at City Hall on the weekends, but he has access to all the offices.
I asked why she wanted to go to City Hall.
Edward Reinhardt should be in the records, and you might want to look at copies of your mother's marriage license and your birth certificate. Nothing like hard data.
After I saw Laurie to her car and she drove away, I walked toward Lanyard Street and Toby Craft's pawn shop. According to Toby, long ago the street had been called Whore's Alley, but these days all the best hookers were married to money and lived in Ellendale. I began moving down Ferryman's Road at the top end of Triangular Merchants Park. Three-story brick buildings set back on postcard lawns lined both of the streets. At the top of the steps, before the first building in the row, a heavy-set man in a tan uniform was flipping through a ball of keys. I noticed the legend carved on a stone headpiece over the front door. The Cobden Building. Here was where Stuart Hatch did whatever he did with his father's money. The guard's eyes fell on me. He looked too old for his job.
A lot of keys, I said.
A lot of doors.
Do you work for Mr. Hatch?
15 years. You new in town?
I told him I was there for a couple of days.
You should take a walk around Hatchtown. See the real Edgerton.
At the wide end of the park, I turned right on Chester Street and walked through a neighborhood of rooming houses and apartment buildings. On Lanyard Street, the three brass balls of a pawn shop hung above an empty sidewalk. I pushed the bell and Toby Craft came into view.
Get in here, will you? What a lousy deal. Kid, your mother was a champ. How about a schnocker?
Yeah, why not? Toby waved me into a small hot room with fluorescent lights. Old calendars with pictures of naked, lushly upholstered women plastered the walls. I sat down on a folding chair. He took a liter of Johnny Walker Black and two smudgy glasses from a bottom drawer of his desk.
Sorry about the no ice. I wish it was a happier occasion. Here's a star.
We clinked glasses.
You getting on okay?
Pretty well. I saw Joy today. He tilted back in his chair and smiled.
Joy is a very unhappy person.
I took another swallow of whiskey and thought about what to say. I don't suppose a lot of Dunstan babies were born with wings and claws, but there must have been something funny about a couple of Howard's brothers and sisters, because Clark mentioned it too. Toby propped his head on the back of his chair.
Joy always felt left out. You notice how she talks about her daddy all the time?
I nodded.
Howard was a strange guy, but him and Queenie always got along. Queenie knew how to handle the old man, but Joy only knew how to get sore.
Joy says she inherited psychic powers from her father, and all that's left of them is enough to pick Clarence out of his wheelchair, lower him into the tub, clean him up, dry him off, and move him back into the chair.
I'll give her this, Ned. Her stories are getting better. But this is what you came here to talk about?
Toby, you know more than I do, and everyone else refuses to say anything at all.
Star didn't want you to know about what passed down through your family, starting with Omar and Sylvan. You heard about Omar and Sylvan.
Oh, yes, particularly from Joy. Joy's frail voice told me.
My grandfathers, they were the surviving remnants of pagan gods. Sylvan had the ancestral house in England taken apart stone by stone, and he shipped all those stones and bricks across the sea and put them back together again.
Toby took another slug of whiskey.
Joy could have had the decency to keep her mouth shut. Your mother wanted to protect you. You were normal. When Joy was a baby, I guess, if she didn't get fed on time, shit went flying all over the place. Windows broke. All that happened was you had those fits on your birthday.
How much did Howard pass down to Queenie?
My wife had a lot of Dunstan in her. Sometimes she'd rise up a couple feet off the bed and hang there, sound asleep.
Toby refilled both glasses.
May got her share. When May was about 13, she was going down Wagon Road. That's Cordwainer Avenue now, in Howard's rumble seat. Well, Queenie told me, May saw two girls pointing at her from another car, you know, laughing at her. Whatever the hell she saw made her so mad she put on a fireworks display. Smashed windshields all up and down Wagon Road, blew out tires. Everything went crazy.
I asked if he knew anything about Star's father.
Queenie said Star's father was a jazz drummer, but she didn't tell me his name.
I felt the clarity of a long overdue understanding. Oh boy, I just got it. My mother had me put into foster care to protect me from her family.
Well, yeah. She wanted you to have a regular life, Ned. By the time we wrap this up, was there anything else?
Oh, just one more thing. Star managed to get out a few words about my father. She said his name was Edward Reinhardt. Toby peered at me through the thick lenses.
I never met this Reinhardt, but he got around was my impression. A certain guy might be able to help you.
He marched behind his desk, sat down, scribbled, tore the top sheet off the pad, folded it in half, and passed it to me.
I didn't give you this name. Hasta la vista.
After I left Toby's, the more I walked, the better I got at it. The combination of alcohol and night air struck my nervous system. At last I reached Merchants Park and stumbled to a bench. I dropped into its embrace and fell asleep. I awakened with a pounding head and an ache in my gut. It was 11:35. I had been passed out on the bench for at least an hour and a half. Aunt Nettie and Clark were not yet so soundly asleep that I could get to my room unheard. Before me lay an hour of free time. I straightened my necktie and walked not all that unsteadily out of the park in search of the night-blooming Edgerton. Two streets, vivid with neon signs and theater marquees, extended eastward from Chester. I picked Word Street because it was closer. Splashes of neon light lay across dirty brick and flaking timbers. Men in worn-out clothes ducked in and out of the bars. Here was a survival of the Edgerton, where crews and passengers from the steamers had disembarked to gamble, visit bordellos, gape at the dancing bears and two-headed goats at the fairground, have their palms read and their purses cut. The town had remained essentially the same, at least if you stood in my great-great-grandfather's Edgerton late on a Friday night. Seconds after entering Dove Lane, I learned that there was another separate old town. A maze of twisting lanes sprouted smaller, darker passages. At the next corner, I turned right into Leather Lane. From leather, I turned into fish, then lavender, raspberry, button, treacle, and wax. About the time I left Button Lane, I became aware of footsteps behind me, though I saw no one when I looked back. Wax led into Veal Yard, where light shone upon a dry fountain from the windows of the Brazen Head Hotel. I circled into Turnip. I looked over my shoulder and glimpsed a dark, moving shape. I hurried over the slippery cobbles and emerged once again into the bustle of Word Street. A hand closed at my left elbow.
Buddy, I don't know about brains, but you do got balls.
The disheveled old man beside me grinned up at my surprise.
Piney Woods, remember me?
I wasn't here on Thursday night. But I heard about you from my Uncle Clark.
Unless you don't happen to be here now, either. You better slide back into Turnip.
He pointed at four men with rocky faces and shirts open over T-shirted guts who were assembling in front of the Speedway Lounge. Three of the men carried baseball bats. My old poker buddies, I suppose. Which one is Staggers?
Him in the fatigue pants.
Him in the fatigue pants had the spoiled, seamed face of a man who had never recovered from the disappointment of learning that he did not rule the world after all. I heard someone following me, Piney.
Like I said, you're lucky. You should get out of Hatchtown pronto.
I hurried back into Veal Yard.
Pitch Lane wound deeper into Hatchtown. I ran down it, hoping that it would lead me to the vicinity of Lanyard Street and Toby Craft's pawn shop. I heard again the click of approaching footsteps. When I came to Lavender, I looked to my left. A ragged boy regarded me from the door of an abandoned building. He jerked his thumb toward his shoulder and stepped back, and I jumped through the opening into lavender-scented darkness. Against the rear wall, a huddle of boys slept beneath tangled blankets. I prowled down the wall, looking for a gap wide enough to see through. My savior followed me.
After you?
Thanks for your help. Where's a bit of money, then? I pulled a bill from my pocket and gave the dollar to the boy.
Wanna hurt you?
I squatted on my heels and put my eye to the crack. From the back of the warehouse, someone whispered,
"Shove him in the knacker, Nolly."
A t-shirted paunch and a thick arm holding a baseball bat heaved into view, then moved away. And soon my rescuer and I slipped back through the door. "Can you help me find my way out of here?" Nolly extended a grubby hand, and I surrendered another dollar. He set off down Lavender in the direction opposite to that taken by my pursuer. A second later came the overlapping sound of leather soles ticking against stone cobbles. Nolly pointed to a dim opening.
"Take silk. Go silk, glass, beer, and you're out."
He raced into an adjacent lane. The approaching footsteps grew louder. I ran into silk. At the bottom of the lane, I jogged toward the lamp at the next crossing of the lanes. In front of me, a broad figure shifted around the corner, raised a baseball bat, and charged. At that moment, someone grabbed my collar, spun me aside, and pushed me under the cobbles. When I raised my head, I saw him pounce, stride forward and leap like a tiger upon the man in front of me. The baseball bat scraped against the side of the passage, flashed upward, and swung down. I heard a squashy, battered watermelon noise. The man at the crossing of the lanes took an unhurried step into the light and turned to face me. Terror glued me to the cobblestones. My obscene double glimmered at me in affectionate, mocking contempt. I realized that Star had given me his name. Robert had shown himself to me. Helplessly, as if to follow, I stepped forward, then turned and ran.
What comes over me? What demon undoes me with visitations of the riverbankish state? Who am I? Who is my true father? I here record my breakthroughs in the order they were granted. Revived from the sense of revenge given me by the Star Sow's passing, I spent the day perusing the Providence Master's sacred texts. Until this very day, I had not taken in the relevance of these lines. At a guess, I'll guarantee to lead you to 30 or 40 alleys and networks of alleys. It was later that I seized the opportunity to slip out and partake of the night air. I went adventuring through Hatchtown's byways and hidden courts. In my progress up Word Street, I noticed 4 middle-aged ruffians skulking out of Purse Lane. 3 of the 4 carried baseball bats. I sauntered invisible alongside the bully boys. Their commander muttered this heavenly imprecation.
"Dunstan's around somewhere. Check out the alleys and meet me back at the speedway."
My heart, that old warhorse, foamed at the bit. My long-delayed encounter with Master Dunstan would not occur until the brat's birthday. But in the meantime, it was my ironic duty to protect him from harm. I went gliding up horsehair with every anticipation of spilling a quantity of Monktree blood. I ducked into Veal Yard, and the music for which I had been searching came to me. High-style footwear amongst Monktree's finest. I got myself once more in motion. I rushed through the byway and heard mystifyingly the hallucinatory footsteps and those of a child moving down Lavender. Eventually, I came near enough to recognize the child as Nolly Weedle. The exercise suddenly became clear. Though my only begotten son might have occult powers denied his father, he didn't know beans about geography. He had hired Nolly to lead him out. At the opening under glass, I wedged myself against the bricks, looked out at a lamplit corner,
and was given the greatest revelation of the day. A man in a dark suit ran forward and trotted toward my niche. Before he had come close enough to the light to expose his face, the bully boy lumbered around the corner, raised his bat, and attacked. I crept out to put an end to the lout. Then, bafflingly, a second form, in every way similar to the first, sprinted down the lane. One of them was my son, but which? The new arrival pushed the tourist aside and leaped upon the roughneck. Surely, this was my son. The commission of a violent homicide had ruffled him no more than it would his old man. But what in the world was he up to? And who or what was the replica whose life he had saved? My foe strolled glittering into the spotlight. He was posing. Slowly, after a beautifully timed delay, my formidable son and adversary vanished down the intersecting lane. As if linked by an elastic band, the other stumbled into the circumference of the lamplight. I was looking at the same face, more or less. Considerably more than less. They were brothers. Star had given birth to two boys, and while I had vainly sought the first, it was the second son, apparently named Ned, whose shadow self had floated behind me on their mutual birthday. Star's death had summoned them both to Edgerton. Stunned, the lad moved forward to pursue his brother, shuddered back, and skedaddled. I have been given what I needed all along.
How I found my shadow at last, and what it did. It was 4:56 a.m., and Lieutenant Rowley had been having a wonderful time since 3:30, when he and Officer Truhaft had awakened Aunt Nettie and Uncle Clark, charged into my room, read my Miranda rights, and arrested me for the murder of a man named Minor Keys. At the police station, Rowley was just getting into his stride.
Funny how the money in your room matches what Staggers and the others say you took off them.
I wasn't in town on the night of the card game. I met an assistant D.A., Ashley Ashton, from Louisville, who told me she could give me a ride here yesterday. Last night I ran into Mrs. Ashton and Mrs. Hatch at Le Madrigal, and they invited me to their table for dinner. After that I went to see Toby Kraft. I drank too much. On the way home I got as far as Merchants Park and passed out on a bench. I got back to my aunt's house around 12:15, 12:30.
We'll find Mrs. Ashton, but it won't have any bearing on what happened at 12:26 last night.
Rowley took me downstairs to a cell. I stretched out on the cot and surprised myself by going to sleep. The clanging of the door woke me up. A gray-haired man with a pink, weary face that had a lot of miles on it walked into the cell.
On your feet, Mr. Dunstan. We're releasing you. I'm Captain Mullen. For the present, no charges will be brought against you. I'd like to request that you remain in Edgerton for the next 48 hours and inform us of any changes of address.
My mother's funeral is on Wednesday. I won't leave before that. Mullen shoved his hands into his pockets.
You must be an old-fashioned gentleman, Mr. Dunstan. Mrs. Ashton confirmed that she met you Wednesday night and drove you here the following day. She also tells us that you could not have been involved in an encounter with Mr. Keys at 12:26 this morning because you came to her at the Merchant's Hotel at approximately 11 o'clock and did not leave until exactly 12:25.
When I returned to Cherry Street, Aunt Nettie and Aunt May attended to my edited version of the night's events as they mopped up the contents of their plates. Clark shoveled in his one true meal of the day.
Mountry boys are stupider than mud, but they're persistent. Best pack your things and give Toby a call. When they come around here, we can say you took off and we don't know where.
I saw the box the UPS driver had delivered. Aunt Nettie followed my gaze.
About time you looked through your mother's few things.
Upstairs, I set the carton on the bed and ripped it open. I took out some old paperbacks and one hardback book and sorted through the 30 or 40 CDs Star had shipped home. At the bottom of the box lay a wallet-sized photograph and an envelope on which Star had written, "For Ned." I picked up the photograph. At first saw only an image of a small boy in a striped shirt, then realized that the small boy was myself, and the photograph had been taken on the morning of my third birthday. I opened the envelope. It contained what looked like a safety deposit key taped to an index card above the words, "Illinois State Provident Bank, Grace Street." I picked up the hardback. I opened the book and turned to the title page. "From Beyond, Tales of the Unknown," by Edward Reinhardt. I turned the page and saw, copyright 1957, Edward Reinhardt. On the facing page was a dedication, "For the Providence Master and My Great Fathers." The table of contents listed 10 or 12 stories. Words like "abandoned," "crypt," and "hideous" swam up at me. My eye took in a title called "Blue Fire." I crammed the book into my knapsack, went downstairs, and called Toby Kraft. He told me to go to a rooming house on Chester Street.
The landlady's an old acquaintance of mine, a woman named Helen Jeanette. I'll set it up in 5 minutes, get you a cheap rate.
The cab deposited me in front of a building like a cardboard box mounted with a peaked hat. I went up the steps and pushed the button beside Jeanette. An interior door opened. An economical, white-haired woman bored gimlet eyes into me.
"I suppose you're the one from Toby Kraft. This is the deal. I'm giving you a nice, comfortable room on the second floor. You and Mr. Brayman have exclusive access to the bathroom at your end of the hall."
A door behind me clicked open. I glanced over my shoulder. A gaunt old man with a Neanderthal jaw, a mesh T-shirt, and a brown fedora was leaning against the opening to a darkened room.
"This is Mr. Tite," she said.
I turned around and held out my hand. He ignored it.
"The room is $30 per night. No cooking, no loud noises. You pay utilities, including your phone. Your room is at the front, above Mr. Tite."
In my room, I hung up my clothes, shoved things into the dresser drawers, and called Merchant's Hotel and asked for Mrs. Ashton.
"My God, are you all right? I couldn't believe those guys. Why didn't you tell them you were here with me?"
She giggled. "Lieutenant Rowley has a filthy mind. I said we gabbed away, but I could tell he knew exactly what we were doing. You know what? You were like the way you were in Chicago. Sort of dangerous. Not drunk. Dangerous. Unpredictable."
My insides folded into origami. "Sometimes I surprise myself," I said. I told her that I'd moved out of my aunt's house and gave her my new telephone number.
"Am I going to see you today, Ned?"
"I don't know. Someone is going to help me track down some information. I'll call you if I can." When we were done, I dialed police headquarters and asked a desk sergeant to give Captain Mullen my new address and telephone number. I went into the hallway. The man in the room across from mine caught my eye and beamed so widely that his handsome white mustache nearly touched his ears. He jabbed a thick forefinger at his chest.
"Otto Brayman."
I pointed at myself. "Ned Dunstan."
"Drop in any time, Ned. Doors always open."
Directly across from the library was the four-square brick structure of the Illinois State Provident. A bank officer who looked about 18 years old checked that I, along with Star Dunstan, was one of the box holders. Downstairs, I opened a panel, pulled out a wide steel container. A package wrapped in butcher paper had been wedged inside the box. From its weight and dimensions, I thought it was a photo album, and I would have opened it on the spot if I hadn't been about to meet Laurie Hatch. Laurie was standing in front of the library on the other side of Grenville Street. She broke into an incandescent smile.
"I'm glad you're early. Stuart did his usual number and screwed up my plans. He has to bring Cobby back around 3 o'clock. What's in that package? Did you rob the bank?"
I told her about the key in the envelope and the safety deposit box. "It's like a Russian doll. Inside the box is an envelope. Inside the envelope is a key that opens a box with another box inside it.
and inside that box, there's a package wrapped in brown paper. Maybe it's stuffed with $100 bills. She took it from me and weighed it in her hands. However, it feels more like a photo album. Let's put your fortune in my car. Then let's see Hugh Coventry. Ever since he took over the Edgerton Library, it ticks like a Swiss clock. One day he wandered to City Hall to inquire about volunteering. The records office spread wide its official arms and said, "Come right in, Mr. Coventry." Thereafter, Coventry has been given the run of the building. She told me how 2 years before, when Edgerton's upcoming 150th birthday had presented itself as an occasion for celebration, the new co-chairman of the Sesquicentennial Committee, Stuart Hatch and Grenville Milton, asked for Coventry's aid in assembling a visual record of the city's past. Laurie had met him when Stuart had installed her on the committee. The arrangement had endured until Laurie's defection from her marriage. On the second floor of City Hall, a single office door glowed yellow. The door bumped open. A tall, fair-haired man backed into the corridor holding an armful of manila folders. "Laurie, what are you doing here?" "Ned, this is the legendary Hugh Coventry. Hugh, my friend Ned Dunstan. I was hoping you could help my friend dig up some information about his father. Coventry's eyes lit up. "Your name is Dunstan? You're one of the Edgerton Dunstans? You're from one of the most fascinating families in this city. You must be related to Annette Rutledge. Mrs. Rutledge sent over a wonderful collection of Dunstan family photographs. I hate to say this, but they seem to be misplaced for the time being. I'm sure we'll find them in the next day or two." I told him Mrs. Rutledge was my mother's aunt, and I hoped he might be willing to help me. My mother was Valerie Dunstan. She gave me her family name, although she was married. Before she died, she told me that my father was named Edward Reinhardt. I'd be grateful for whatever you could tell me. Coventry went in an office and to a computer on the far side of a desk. He shifted the mouse and tapped keys. "According to this, Donald Mesmer married Valerie Dunstan on the 25th of November, 1957. "Something's wrong," Laurie said. "Ned's father was named Edward Reinhardt." Coventry did a lot of things with the mouse. "The birth certificate ought to tell us something. What was your date of birth?"
"June 25th, 1958.
He beamed at me. "Right around the corner. Happy birthday, in case I don't see you before that." Coventry cleared his throat. "Name of infant, Ned Dunstan. Date of birth, June 25th, 1958. Mother's name, Valerie Dunstan. Father's name, Donald Mesmer. Attending physician, none. Attending midwife, Hazel Jansky." He looked back at me. "They would have obtained the father's name from your mother." His essential decency made him hesitate. "But it's certainly possible for a pregnant woman to marry another man." I nodded. "We have to go now, but could I see you again? I'd like to look up a few other things." "Come back tomorrow morning. The doors will be locked, but if you bang hard enough, I'll hear you." Laurie turned the key in the ignition and nudged the accelerator. "We have to get in touch with this Mesmer. Posey Fairbrother, Cobby's nanny, has a CD-ROM with addresses and telephone numbers from a million different cities. Now, where are we going?" I showed her the slip of paper. Toby's slash-and-burn handwriting spelled out the name Max Edison and VA Hospital, Mount Vernon. We moved out into the traffic and headed toward the expressway. "Tell me how you met Stuart Hatch," I said. Laurie told me that 5 years earlier, a reasonably attractive man of about 40 had stationed himself beside her near midpoint of a party at a townhouse owned by an executive at the NBC affiliate in San Francisco. Stuart Hatch was neither charmless nor anything like too old, yet he did not interest her, especially when he confessed to being a businessman from an obscure city in Illinois. After 3 years of doing background for the news staff, Laurie knew she had a chance for an opening as an on-camera reporter. The Illinois tycoon might as well have been a black hole in a distant galaxy. Laurie said, "The rat chased me until I fell in love with him." "What went wrong?" "Stuart wanted a son right away. Not just a baby, a son. His grandfather, Carpenter, set up this complicated family trust that keeps passing the money to a first-born male child, like something out of the Middle Ages." The details of the extraordinary trust were so complicated that I forgot most of them as soon as they were out of her mouth.
What I retained was that Cobden Hatch, Stewart's father, had modified its conditions so that evidence of criminal behavior eliminated the possibility of inheritance. Apparently, his black sheep brother had embarrassed the family. In other words, Laurie said, if Stewart is convicted of embezzlement and tax fraud and whatever, Cobby gets it all. You have no doubts that Stewart is guilty?
None.
I don't get it. He was risking everything. You don't know Stewart. Whatever he did out of state through phony companies with bank accounts in the West Indies. He's still sure he'll walk away free and clear. But why would he do it in the first place?
He's greedy and impatient. And now my tale is done, because coming up on our left is the VA hospital.